accession number 23370, reel 18.
Tell us about some of the other chaps that were in there. You mentioned that there were a whole mix of different people with different experiences, yep. I presume.
Oh, yes. There were people from anywhere in Australia, anywhere in the British Isles, and there were a few Americans, not very many. But apart from that, they were about the main run of the various nationalities. Of course, in that you get Scots and Irish and all the rest of them. But generally speaking, they were in that sort of category. But they had been all over the place, and a lot of them, of course, had been on the other end of the railway from where we were, and although we had been there for a lot longer period, the severity of their treatment on the other end of the line had been far, far worse than what we'd had, although in a lot of cases it was only for a couple of months. But the treatment there was absolutely brutal, and they had had bad patches of cholera and had lost a lot of people with cholera, plus the treatment that they were having there. As far as food was concerned, was absolutely terrible, and they never had the huts that we had. They had very bad conditions, as bad as we thought we were off. They were worse off. They had a pretty fair smattering of doctors with them. They'd given them a lot of help, of course, plus the medical staff, blokes who were orderlies or they'd be known as nurses these days, and some of the things that they did were absolutely out of this world. You know, when we found out about it, it was quite amazing. But they had actually survived that, you know, even though it was only a relatively short period. But that was the real sick end of the whole railway thing. They had experienced, or they had walked right into the speedo end of the thing. But we had a month or so before it started. Of sort of reasonable amount of work, but these blokes walked straight into it.
So you had to sort of prepare yourselves for what was to come.
Oh, not a bit. You couldn't prepare yourself very much for anything because you didn't know it was coming. But yes, it got worse gradually until the real speedo started, and then it was vicious. But yes, what we learned from these blokes had been on the Thailand end of the line. They really had a tough time there, and there was a bit of a miracle that so many blokes came out of it. It was good.
Did people tend to sort of keep to themselves in groups? For instance, the English, the Americans, people that experienced similar?
A lot of it was done by our own administration. the Japs never interfered with the internal administration or anything, so virtually the army in particular kept their people in battalions, if you like, or in their units, because they were known to each other, that sort of thing. But then, of course, you've got the odd bods like us who were thrown in onto the end of anything. Anywhere there was a space, we got chucked in. But in Changi, there were only, four of us. There was Maggie Moore, who was the chief cook, and Sid Harper, Bubbles Elliott, and myself. They were the four of us. Well, Bubbles, Sid and I, we were all of the same age and same ilk, etc. Well, Maggie Moore, he was a chief cook, and he was quite some years older than us, and he was up with the sergeant, so he stayed up there. He never went out to work. He was just too ill. He was too frail, actually, to go out and work, but the rest of us were strong enough to go out and work, so we were on the work parties the whole time.
You mentioned earlier on food. Did you get food parcels in Changi?
Not individually. You were given, there were things like some sweets and that sort of thing that you would have been handed out. But of course, when you get food parcels and there's only one amongst six or that sort of thing, there's not very much to hand out. But generally speaking, what they did was to what they could they would put into the general kitchen, so that they went out to everybody.
You wanted to mention an experience with food parcels from earlier on. Had you sort of actually ever had a food parcel up until this point?
Yes, we had one food parcel when we were at the 100 camp, which would have been July, August 1943. That was the first time that we had had anything from the Red Cross. We got a food parcel. The food parcels were coming. The word was told to us that the Red Cross parcels were coming, and we expected one each. But they gave us one parcel to 12 men. And highly suspected that the rest of them were hijacked and used by the Japs. They seemed to be of the opinion that we shouldn't get any more than they did. So, you suspect that they hijacked them and used them themselves.
Can you describe how you would chop up a parcel to 12 blokes?
Well, yes, it was generally done. The catering officer who was in charge, he worked out a system whereby that you would get everybody would get pretty much the same sort of thing, and of course once you got it and you wanted to swap it or trade it, or you found something that you liked a bit better than somebody else, or you didn't smoke or you wanted to smoke or that sort of thing. So there was individual trading with those things, but no, there wasn't much in a parcel, in a 12th of a parcel, I can assure you. But that was the first indication that we got that the Red Cross was going to do something or was doing something for us. We knew that the The Japs didn't think very much of the Red Cross and were not too keen on allowing stuff in or out.
Were you ever able to remind them of their obligations that they were supposed to keep in regard things like food parcels and how they would treat people and POWs?
I can mention one particular officer that we had. His name was Kennedy, Captain Kennedy, John Kennedy, as it happened. He was a captain in the 2nd, 3rd machine gunners from Adelaide. And he was our adjutant, I guess you'd call him, for the liaison between us and the Japanese. And he was a big bloke, very genial sort of character, but he took some awful punishment from those Japs, and particularly for that sort of thing, for reminding them of their obligations and what they should do and what they shouldn't do. And of course, to their way of thinking, we had no rights whatsoever. But of course, our Black Jack, as he was known, he used to remind them constantly, and boy, that man took some beatings simply because he was doing just that. And he finished up that he took so many beatings that it eventually affected his voice, because he'd beat me in the head that much. And as I understand it, affected him in later life too, just the sheer number of physical beatings that he took. So we come back from work at the end of the day and found him standing outside of the guardhouse, and he'd been there all day, just standing, not allowed to go anywhere, not allowed to go to the toilet or have a drink or anything. And when you do that, if you do that all day or for most of a day, and in the conditions that were there, because it was either in the hot sun or we were standing in rain, that sort of thing. But that's the sort of attitude that they had to that sort of thing. If you spoke about the Red Cross, being you were in for trouble, you know. You took the line of least resistance with that sort of thing. But our Black Jack, he was pretty fierce and constant about that sort of thing.
As I understand, from July 1944, there was a more repressive Japanese guard. Why do you think that took place? Why do you think they were more repressive around that time?
Oh, they were frightened. They were scared. You could see it in the guards themselves. Around about that time, Changijiao was situated on the top of a rise, and about a half a mile away, down in one of the lower areas, they installed an old naval gun, or the naval gun. I'm talking about something like about a 5-inch naval gun, and this was anticipated that this was going to be the way that things were going to happen, that we were all going to be shoved in the jail and they were going to bombard it. That was the general, the theory. But of course, until something starts to happen, you don't make things happen. Wait until it starts and then go for the leg of your life then. But you didn't want to invite trouble before it actually started. But yes, they were scared. At that time, there were constant bombings in and around Singapore. Allies knew where the Changi camp was, and they knew where most of the camps were, and consequently they kept away. But with a lot of these bombings and so forth, they were done in daylight, and of course we could see it all, and as much as the Japs didn't like us watching it, it was there, it was on. And I think during that whole time we only ever saw one Allied plane get shot down, but we saw several their fighters get shot down, etc. And of course, quite obviously, the war was going very much against them. Even if you didn't have access to a radio, you could see the war was going badly against them. And of course, we had news at that time, and there were radios within the camp in an official capacity sort of thing, and you'd get items of news would be given out at the evening parade or that sort of thing, in a very covert manner, so that you didn't attract the attention of the Japs while you were being told news, because you weren't supposed to gather in big numbers, that sort of thing. But round about that time also, we were, as far as work was concerned, we were digging an enormous number of foxholes. These were tunnels dug into the side of a hill and in a U shape, so that there was an entry and an exit sort of thing. But it was pretty tough going as far as work was concerned. It wasn't easy work. The only thing that, or one of the things that occurred while you were out at work, was that you were always able to scrounge food out of the Chinese gardens. This was done with the guards turning a blind eye to it, because they were also partaking of part of what we scrounged. The sort of thing that occurred was that two blokes would go off from the work and would go away and scrounge some material of some sort, and bring it back so that everybody could partake, because we used to be able to cook out on the job, so you could get this stuff. But this particular day, these two blokes, one was a black-haired bloke, and the other bloke had hair, flaming red hair, and these two went out with a kit bag each, and just before lunchtime there's a hell of a noise coming, and suddenly the red-headed and the black-head come scooting around the corner with a bag full of goodies, and straight into the tunnel. Put them in the tunnel, and right on their heels was a Chinaman screaming his head off, because these blokes had not only pinched some vegetables, they'd also pinched a couple of his chooks, and he was most upset, and the Japs wouldn't let him in, and he wanted to go in the tunnel and find his stuff. They wouldn't let him in there. That was intelligence stuff. He wasn't allowed in there, so the poor old China, but he never got much of a go. And he wanted to have a parade of everybody, so everybody came out all covered with mud and slush and this sort of thing that you normally did. And he picked these two in a flash. But, they've been there all the time, so... They nicked him off out of it, and The Jap finished up with 1.5 of the chooks, and we only had half a chook. So, but they were fairly rare incidents where you got the. Generally, the Chinese were very, very. Tolerant of all that sort of thing, and didn't worry us too much. So you could go and pinch a few bits of vegetable, and I didn't worry very much, because if you were a bit blatant about it, like these two were, they used to raise a bit of cane. But work, yes, this was all our work was all defence work. Cutting or going into swamps and cutting what we call snake wood. It's long, thin timber material, and it laces very well in the ground between posts and so forth, and it's very strong. And they use this for barricades and that sort of thing. A bit archaic, but in the present day warfare, of course, they were just skipped over the top with those sort of things, and they wouldn't have stopped a tank or anything like that. But I guess it was something to do. But yes, they were very, very frightened and very scared at that time, and just after that, we also started to get some of the first time we'd seen jet planes came screaming across over the top of Changi, and we wondered what the devil it was for a start, but that's what it was these. The first of the jets, and also there was some of the P-38s, these American twin fuselage fighters. They came screaming over the top of the camp. They were only showing off, and it was a big morale booster as far as we were concerned. Because these bloody things, they were flying at that time. What do they call them? Hurricanes and Spitfires. They were doing about 360 miles an hour. Well, these other things were doing, 450 up to 500 miles an hour. And of course, you no sooner hear them and they're gone. You know, and suddenly there's this enormous roar out of the top of the camp, they were things that really filled the Japs with some sort of terror, because they were something that they hadn't experienced before. Well, these things were they come screaming over, and of course they didn't shoot anything or didn't, but they were just morale boosters as far as we were concerned. One of them came over at one stage behind the tower block of the jail. There was a big chimney, and there was barely room between the chimney and the jail block, but this bloody plane flew through there, and how the devil he did, I don't know, but and just screamed, and he was that low that he was sort of just barely over the top of the jail building, of course the Japs were this was really beyond them, because just after that we had the guards starting to look for money. They were starting to want to buy Australian money, English money, American money, Singapore dollars, anything at all. I'd give you, 50 to 1 with this worthless bloody invasion money, this sort of thing. But that was a very good sign as far as we were concerned. you know, and you get a guard wanting to buy your money. That was a very clear indication to us that it wasn't very far away.
Did the Japanese guards at all become friendlier as a result of them knowing what might be heading their way?
Yes, they became more tolerant, if you like. Not exactly friendly, but more tolerant. And you could see they were thinking very clearly about which way the wind was blowing. But it was quite interesting at the time because we didn't quite know who was going to get there first, whether they were going to start and blast us with this gun or whether the Allies were going to get there first. But as it happened, yes, the our blokes got there first, thank goodness. But the of course, as soon as the atomic blasts had taken place, or the atomic bombing of Nagasaki and what have you, as soon as that was occurred, that was when we were told also. We were gathered together on a particular night in the huts. Each hut had a warrant officer in charge of the hut, and he gathered us all together, and they had blokes standing at the end of each hut so that nobody could be, no Japs could sneak up on us or that sort of thing, because you weren't supposed to hold gatherings. But he told us, RWA told us that the atomic blasts had taken place, and that what was it, Nagasaki, and the other one was
Hiroshima.
Yeah. That they had blasted the place off the face of the earth, and of course there was more to come, and that was a very big turning point, of course, for the whole thing.
This was August of 45.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
How long had it been, do you think, that you really knew things were going your way? I was mentioning July of 44, that the repressive Japanese regime took over, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So it was... Would you say that it was clear a year ahead?
Oh, yes, yeah. We knew that the thing had started to turn in our favour at that time. But you didn't start to see the very clear signs as far as the Japs were concerned, because they got a different news service to us. And their news service, of course, was that things were going right. They had a tendency to try and follow Goebbels' ideas, you know, that if you tell a big enough lie often enough, people will believe it. And this seemed to be the attitude of the Japs, that they were believing that sort of thing, and still believed that somebody, the sun, was going to do something and you know, bring them luck again or this sort of thing. Because every morning when they're on guard duty, they have this little ceremony or rite or what have you, and they go out and take their hats off and line up. This is the guards that are on duty, and bow towards the sun and go through this this little ritual they go through. But we always reckon that they used to say, "Yes, you are the cause of all this. Yes, you are the cause of all this." But of course, that was a prayer as far as they were concerned. But that's what we reckon that they used to say.